Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. I'm the producer, Tun Miai, and I'm here with host Dina Brodsky. Hey, Dina, so what's happening in your neck of the woods this weekend?
Okay, well, there's a really exciting first grade soccer game I'm attending for one of my kids. But other than that, I am teaching an Instagram for Artists class, and it still has two spots left. So for any Art Grind listener who wants one of those two spots, if you use the discount code ArtGrindPodcast, it gives you $50 off the live class, and I guess would also work for the recorded class. So yeah, this is for everyone who is really, really frustrated by the Instagram algorithm and wants to know what to do about it. So just come with any questions you have, and I'll stay online as long as anyone has questions left.
Thanks, Dina. I definitely recommend Dina's class because she has been helping me with Instagram and helped me grow my account, The Miang Projects, from zero to where it is now, which is 93K. So the stuff works. Check it out.
Well, it's Tun's beautiful curatorial account, which you would have probably figured out how to grow anyway. But, you know, the algorithm voodoo, it helped it grow faster.
Dina is the Instagram whisperer, and I've seen the proof. And if you do what she tells you to do, it will work. So do what she tells you to do, and it will grow your account.
Tun, that sounds so sinister. I'm not a whisperer. I'm an Instagram witch. Yeah. I cast the spells. So.
Exactly.
Hello, everyone. Today we are interviewing Leo Mancini-Resco. He was great. It's a friend that Dina's had for a while. He's a great painter, went to Florence Academy, really knows his stuff about, you know, the material aspects of it, art supplies, conservation. He has gone through the Academy program, taught there a little bit, has a really accomplished painter. And he and Dina were in detention together. So
I guess we never went into the story of why we're in detention. But in any case, if you don't want to hear about that, you can skip over the first 10 minutes and just hear kind of the art part of his journey.
It was nice talking to a contemporary. Like, we usually interview people older who have a lot of life and you sort of want to honor their story. But this one, we were able to get into conversations like AI and our generation coming up in art, what a tumultuous time all that was. And there was a lot of common ground there. So it was a great conversation.
So maybe we should interview people our own age sometime. I mean, I think I'm the reason why we don't. Like I'm the one that wants some, you know, wants artists that have had like a century of experience. But maybe something like this is good. Maybe we'll make an exception.
Certainly, it certainly is more casual than interviewing someone like Audrey Flack or someone that you just want to honor their whole life, this whole grand life that they've had, you know?
She was also incredibly like connective too. With her, there was like halfway through, I was like, I think I just want to like maybe get down on my knees and be like, do you want to be my friend? Can we have coffee? can we do this again?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. I'm Marshall Jones here with Dina Brodsky. And today our guest is Leo Mancini-Resco. He is a painter. He's involved in art supplies and he does workshops and various things out of his studio. He's a traveling instructor. Leo, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Hi, guys.
How's it going? So yeah. We were just talking, you and Dina were in detention together. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
I think we met when we were both underachieving in various ways. But I have to say, Leo was like a lot more hardcore at underachieving than I was.
I was overachieving in areas that were not school. Is a good way to say it. I mean, I think our underachieving was a little bit different, but yeah, I mean, we went to high school together for a bit and then I stopped going.
Entirely, Leo? Did you graduate or?
I mean, I didn't. I did get a high school diploma from an alternative school, but I don't think that traditional high school was something I was cut out for. I mean, I was the first high school I went to, I was kicked out in just a couple months. And then I went to Brookline High, where I went with Dina. I never made it past freshman year, and I dropped out in my second freshman year.
Yes, I have to say, like, you know, I was around a lot of, due to my own underachievement in various ways, I was around a lot of like kind of chaotic characters. And I have to say, Lou, you were one of the worst. You looked like bad news, even in like ninth grade, when people were like drawn to bad news. So.
Yeah, but that's how you know I wasn't a sociopath, right? Like, I wasn't a charming bad person. I was, you know, you could tell. No, I mean, I was doing a lot of art activities that weren't exactly legal at the time. And I was staying out very late and not doing classes. And I don't think I ever really did homework from the time I was in eighth grade. But the good news is after I had dropped out, I ended up going to this like really interesting alternative school here in Massachusetts called Sebree Valley. And it's sort of a zero class, make your own structure school. And I spent the days like drawing and reading to little kids. And I earned through their process a high school diploma. So I'm both a dropout and not a dropout.
Okay.
Well, that's such a common thread in art, I think. Like, I don't know, Keith Richards famously said that school only teaches you how to assimilate. And I kind of agree. I have a hard time with the education system. What do you guys feel like as parents now, as these
sort of... I mean, we both, like, we also, so we moved back. Did we move back at around the same time? So we moved back like to Brookline, to the place where we grew up with our small children who were like similar enough in age, basically to end up in the educational system that like we both failed spectacularly. And so I don't know, Leo, how do you feel about all of the decisions that like led to that?
It's been, you know, we moved back about 2.5 years ago during the pandemic. And I think I am coming to terms with my previous self from 28 years ago now. You know, it's like, I see all this, my kids are totally different than I am. And I don't think, have the same issues, but it's been interesting seeing the flood of memories, you know.
I actually like refuse to have my kid end up at like the elementary school I went to, because even that's associated with like, I just don't want to be in that building. It's associated with like bad memories.
No
like
comment.
I wrote a special letter to have him somewhere else.
Yeah, my son is going to the grade school that I first went to. So it's a trip.
You know? But for you, people don't fit necessarily in those boxes. And how important is it to try to squeeze who you are into this very tight sort of structure that does not feel particularly useful?
Yeah. I mean, the good news is I think that like American public schools are much better at recognizing square pegs and round holes than they used to be. You know, I think that there's a much larger umbrella of personality types and behaviors and stuff. And we've been confronting some of that stuff in the school. I mean, my kids are, my son's having a very different experience than I did, but it's, you know, he's probably a little bit of a square peg in a round hole too. And I love that. You know, I don't think I was ever type A. And I think that that's a big part of why I'm still here doing this job so many years later, you know?
And by the way, it actually sounds like you sort of like your alternative high school, like sounded like, so you were having a hard time, but like as an adult, imagine how much of a hard time the public school system was having with you, right?
Yeah. Whereas the alternative school's approach was, I mean, it really boils down to like a few sentences, right? It's like, you need to prove to them what you have done to prepare yourself to be a productive member of the larger society, or society at large rather. And I mean, that is a large umbrella, you know, it allows for many different types of people. I had to sort of write a thesis paper on what I had done and what I might do, and read it in front of the entire school group, ages from ages 4 to the founder of the school, who's now, you know, passed away. Yeah, it was really interesting. It was just, the traditional school model, I don't think really worked for me for most of the time. it just wasn't within my sphere of interest at all.
And then where'd you go from there?
So the big issue was that when I was a kid, from a pretty young age, I started doing graffiti, which is how I got into painting and drawing. And I just had the time of my life, but I also got into a huge amount of trouble. And my parents, who were, I think, kind of resourceful and smart enough to not try to just like turn their back on the whole thing, they just signed me up for all the drawing and painting classes they could to try to give me diverse interests and not just doing graffiti. So it turned out I really liked drawing the figure, and I did classes, I think, like RISD, and I did a summer program when I was quite young, and then I did a class at the Museum of Fine Arts School. I ended up going to Art Institute of Boston for a while, but I think it wasn't until I did this study abroad program in Italy through Art Institute of Boston, which was partially to just get me away from all the trouble I was getting in at home, or maybe mostly to get me away from all the trouble I was getting in at home. Because it got very serious. My friends that I was, sorry, the train's going past here. My friends that I was doing graffiti with when I was a kid, I mean, of the group of us, you know, a number of them did 6 months to a year. Some of them got into bigger trouble. It got a little scary, and we were young. So when I went to Italy, I literally stumbled across this school that, this is pre-internet, right? There was no knowledge of ateliers. There was no way I could have found it, but I literally walked past the atelier schools in Florence and found myself eventually at the Florence Academy of Art, which ended up being like a really rigid environment just around painting and drawing. And I think that from that point forward, I was probably for the first time in my life, a good student.
Because it was sort of like what you'd been looking for, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, something very concentrated firmly within my sphere of interest. The bad news with graffiti is like I spent my 17th birthday in county jail in New York. The good news with graffiti is that it's an incredibly disciplined and really fun. I mean, it was like a brotherhood. It was like, you know, the ultimate kind of fraternity growing up. But I found myself in this position where I would just spend all day drawing. I would spend 8 hours a day in sketchbooks, and I would go out and paint. You know, since I was 12 years old, I'd fill a bag with paint and I'd call up a friend and would go somewhere and would paint all day, and then would hang out at somebody's house and draw in sketchbooks all night. And when you think about it, that's sort of 8 to 9 hours of painting and drawing, right? And I've done that since then. I mean, once I got to Florence and it was just free license to paint and draw, and I could still do a little graffiti, you know, there was no vandal squad coming for me. There was no, they weren't raiding my house there. I still did get into a little trouble here and there. I painted some trains and stuff, but yeah, I could apply that 8 to 10 hours a day just painting and drawing, and that same camaraderie and I think really fraternity, brotherhood, family concept applied directly to the atelier thing. So yeah, I think from that, that was in 2000 that I found myself there on a study abroad program. So I then dropped out of the school in Boston. So I dropped out of college too, to go to the Florence Academy of Art. And yeah, I was part of that school for well over 10 years. I mean, I lived in Italy for 11 years. I had a whole life there. Me and my wife were really ingrained, and we miss it very much, but we came back to Boston the Boston area anyway, in 2011.
So was it the situation where you finished the program there and then started teaching in the program, or is that?
Yeah. So, I mean, back then the school was very small. It was not the size or scale that it is today. So I was there as the school was becoming larger and more important. So I was able to get scholarships to pretty quickly get scholarships and then make some relationships with galleries while I was coming out of being a student. So from sort of, 2004-ish, I had started, you know, getting scholarships, doing other stuff. And then I just, it went straight into working as a painter. And then somewhere a few years later, I just became, you know, I was just teaching. I had my own studio outside the school and I was just kind of an artist in residence at the school. Yeah. And we had a great studio. I mean, I shared a beautiful painting studio with some of my close painter friends. And I don't know, thinking back on it, it was like a fun little think tank because we were all very hungry and we all had different ideas. And now for the past 12 years, I've been back here on my own kind of figuring everything out.
It seems like around that era, you were saying pre-internet, there was this beginning of a lot of schools like Florence popping up, and now it seems like they're everywhere. What do you account for that? Like those boutique art schools everywhere, what do you account for the interest in those?
I mean, the internet's changed everything. It's funny enough, it did the same thing to graffiti. With the internet, everybody in every part of the world can now see all these things and figure out things. And with it, there was kind of a loss of, in graffiti, a loss of like regional style that you could no longer tell the difference between somebody doing graffiti from Boston and somebody from New York and somebody from Connecticut. And those things used to be distinct, even though these three cities are really close to one another. Now it's just like the atelier thing. I mean, somebody could be painting in California or France or Italy or whatever, and they'll all have some sort of similar technique figured out. So it yields a fairly similar result. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when I started, it was still the era where they were talking about how, you know, Ives Gamble's just dreaming of a few hundred people being trained well. And I mean, at this point, I think it's pretty safe to admit there's more painters walking the earth than ever before, you know?
Yeah. And I think about that too, like even just like watching social media, like sped up videos of people painting over and over again, like that's an education, like that you weren't exposed to like 4 years ago. Like you could totally watch like 10 of those and know how it's done, you know?
Yeah. And there's maybe a little bit of a loss of, because it's so accessible and so easy, I think maybe there's a little bit of loss of singularity, that like one thing is in particular quite important to you. Like when I started, you still had to take transparencies of paintings to sell galleries, right? And I think a lot of these you know, things that you're talking about, like a sped up reel of somebody painting, you can do an infinite number of those. Right. But there used to be a financial investment in even photographing the piece. You had to believe in it so much. And it's not that long ago, but I think it's changed a lot. And also people seek out things less in person. Right. Like I think one of my favorite things to do when I go to an artist studio is I'd like make a beeline for their bookshelf to see who they had. And now everybody sort of has the same heroes because of what gets repeated online.
Yeah, absolutely. Such a game changer. Like I was reading Jerry Saltz's new book talking about the era that we all started in. He was like, if you're an artist who started in the year 2000, know that you haven't lived a single normal year in the art world, as he would say it, you know. Like financial crisis to Trump years to COVID to just all this crazy shakeup, which impacted the art world a lot.
Okay, Marshall, but what is a normal year? Like this is kind of like BS. What is a normal year in the art world? What is like?
No. You can't say that, Dina, because it stayed very consistent for years. Where think about abstract expressionism to all these movements that came up. And they were fairly boutique and small, and there was a place to sell them, to all of the elements that I just talked about, congealing to mega mass art being consolidated to the top few galleries like Gagosian and this stuff. It has turned into a business like never before seen. So whatever you're about to say about the difficulties of other generations is not true.
No, you know what, Marshall? Have you ever seen the genocide map? Just to really like collapse.
We're talking about the art world.
No.
This is the art world. It changed fundamentally.
We're talking about perspective, Marshall. And like, you know, for all of like the horrible news headlines that we see all the time, if you look at, there is this thing called the genocide map of just, you know, which shows you where there's a genocide taking place in which part of the world. And in every, like, there has never been a time, basically there were never any good old days. My gripe with what you're saying is that it feels like there were these like mythical good old days in the art world where maybe like, I don't know, genuine art had more of a chance. It was always a business, and it was always like the top few gatekeepers, like kind of like holding the, you know, holding the keys. And Jerry Saltz happens to be one of them. He's just very eloquent and convincing. Leo, what do you have to say about that before I run my mouth off?
Let's have a nice light conversation about genocide.
Which was my point, by the way, was genocide.
I think in my experience, pre-2008, things were a little bit different because social media hadn't taken off as much. I think that in my experience, clients used to go to galleries as tastemakers more and really try to believe in the art dealer's sort of vision to, I mean, I just sold everything off the easel for so long. I would just, you know, okay, get a photograph, get a frame, ship it. It would often be sold before it would even arrive. And I think that a lot of people ascribe the financial crisis is really, the 2008 financial crisis is changing that. But I mean, to be honest, like everybody being on social media, flicking through more images in a day than somebody used to see in their entire lifetime, that sort of hit around the same time. Yeah. And I think that it really, in some sense, it devalued paintings because it's not as, people don't search them out to see them in person. I've had people, you know, in workshops and stuff, try to tell me about painters. And it sounds, and I'll ask them, I'm like, oh, have you seen one in person? No, I just looked at it. And a phone is not a good model to really appreciate. I mean, you can appreciate the design and the many different aspects of the picture, but in terms of like the craft of how a painting's made, the presence that it has, the scale of it, I mean, there's just so much that's lost. So I think that, you know, in my experience, I had a very different time before that kind of loosely 2008. But I sort of ascribe it to social media perhaps equally or more so than the financial, because one gallery, you know, a couple galleries, I think did really well post 2008 and others shuttered and others opened. It's just changed the playing field. And it's, I think you sort of figure out how to move from one thing to another as the playing field continues to change.
But do you remember how hard it was? And I know you might be like a little more extroverted than me, but like that world of like going to openings and I don't know, like things, you know, having to meet the collector or the gallery director or whatever it was. I actually found pre-internet art world to be really, really difficult. And like now it's also sometimes difficult, but at least I, you know, I'm less physically stressed out by it.
But at that point, I lived in Italy. So it was like very different experience, I think, than going to openings in New York all the time. I would very occasionally come back to the States for an opening or something. But like in Florence, openings were just big old love fests full of painters. Like, yeah, how are you doing? Like it was really, it felt, I don't know. It was a nice time, partially because the community is, there's so many schools in Florence and there's just this critical mass of, it's a very, very full, very small pond with a few big fish in it. And it was a wonderful time and place to like gain self-confidence and find your feet. But yeah, maybe it's because I'm extroverted. I don't know.
You are extroverted. So I've gone like plein air painting with Leo, and like I'll you know, like, you know, people will stop by, look over your shoulder. Oh. I just sort of like keep, you know, like not making eye contact. Leo, like, you know, 10 minutes later, you know, you guys are like friends and have each other's contact information, like kind of whoever it is. And that's, you know, that's a gift. Like it's a gift you happen to have.
I don't know. Maybe I'm pretty quiet sometimes.
You don't notice that happening? Like like you talk to everyone, and you like find, you know, and you like connect with everyone.
I also, when I'm painting, I sometimes just have headphones in my ears to like not talk to people. I won't even listen to music. I'll just be wanting to concentrate. So it depends entirely what mood I'm in. I think the guy you're talking about, is that the day we were painted at the farm?
Yeah.
So that's the farmer that owns. I have to talk to that guy like every time, and I'm like, oh god, here, like I have to discuss at length everything, because he's like, where are you guys parked? Are you parked here? The tractor's got to come through, and it like always falls on me because I've run a lot of classes for myself and other. I used to teach sometimes at this farm, so if it's that guy in particular, it's part of my whole work thing that I have to be polite.
All right.
So now you teach. How do you find teaching helps your art practice or hinders it?
Yeah, that's an awesome question, because I didn't set out to teach, right? It was something that I fell into. The Florence Academy, again, like that incubator concept at the time, this like real small community kind of vibrating with energy, and very supportive. I only took the teaching scholarship because it was a much better scholarship than the cleaning the toilet scholarship, which was the one I had before. I didn't want to be the janitor. I wanted to do anything but be the janitor. But it turned out over the years that I found that, explaining concepts and verbalizing them and attempting to sort of like reason stuff out from a number of different angles with students is really helpful for your own work. And it was really interesting and turned out to be something that I think I was good at. So the only caveat I would say is that I'm very cautious about the type and amount of teaching that I've done. When I left the school in Florence, which was, again, it was like family, and I think I left on, you know, good terms with everybody, and I was very, but it was sort of time for me to go for a number of reasons. And when we moved back to the States, I figured out pretty quickly that I didn't want to align myself with any institution, that I wanted instead to like really just focus on painting first. And thinking back on when I was a student, without exception, the teachers that were the most impressive and the ones that I really wanted to align myself with were those that had painting careers and interesting painting careers. And I'd want to sort of move a little in their space, help them stretch canvas, whatever, because you just pick up tips along the way. And that kind of, again, that kind of apprenticeship concept is, or was, I don't know how prevalent that is these days, but it was really prevalent at the school. And that's exactly how I came up spray painting. Also, it's like, you know, you'd meet somebody with more experience than you and you'd sort of figure some stuff out. So teaching has been important to me, and I've done it besides the first year of COVID. I've done at least a little bit of teaching continuously for, you know, almost 20 years now. I think it's 19 years or something. So I love it for the reasons that it's, you know, helpful to students. I like the conversation, and I think it affects my work positively. But I never want to be thought of as a teacher. And I promised myself that when I moved back, I would A, not start a school. And B, I would, because many folks today do start schools when they come back, and more power to them. It's awesome. Like it's great that they can do that. But I want to be thought of as a painter first. So that was important to me. And I didn't want to align myself too closely with any institution. So I've taught workshops at many great schools, and I love them, and it's all love. But I don't want to fully align myself with any one didactic method or be an archetype that the school is kind of founded around. I instead want to experiment and paint, and I teach on the side. I have students that come through my studio and I host workshops for other people. So I think of what we do here as more of a art center, a maybe an old school atelier, not what it's thought of today, but certainly not a school. So yeah, that's kind of a long-winded answer of teaching, but it's a complicated thing for me. I mean,
so after however many years at the Florence, you know, Florence Academy, how do you feel about the atelier system now? Like the
I mean, there's positives and negatives within it. The firm belief when I started out was, you know, you only need to train a couple hundred people and we're going to change the world. And to be honest, I'm not sure that's really happened or panned out, but the ateliers are without question some of the best ways to gain a lot of skills really quickly. And most of what I teach is very firmly rooted in like the Florence Academy of Arts method and that methodology, much of what I teach anyway. But I'm very cautious about that concept of a one true way method. I don't like at all this like, oh, if you do exactly X, Y, and Z, you will get great results every time, because a lot of people leave these schools and they'll do excellent academic work. And then they go home and they do more tabletop still lifes and they're excellent tabletop still lifes. But the fact is like, if everybody holds perfectly to this one true way method, you're in a pool that is diluting itself every year, right? Like when I left, there was however many, 50 really good graduates. And now like all these years later, who knows how many grad, and everybody can do a bit of that method. So I love the atelier method, but I'm really cautious about trying to present it as this, if you only do these things, you will be successful and you will always do them. Because that's the way a lot of these schools treat it.
Well, and that's a good point too, because I think that has to do with that. Like it's the explosion of little schools popping up everywhere, like you're saying, because a lot of the place to go with that skill set is to teach it again, you know, and it's sort of pyramid in a way that it just trickles down and more people are doing it, but mm-hmm. there's still not a ton of place for the work to go. You know, it's like, it's the process that's the selling point, and the work seems to not have the money. The career is in teaching if you go that route.
Yep. Yep. And I think it nets you a lot of people that are kind of true believers in the system, and they, you know, I swear to God, they'll leave the school and just be shocked that they don't get a ticker tape parade. And, you know, the Metropolitan's going to come and give a show any minute now. The phone's going to ring and we're going to do the retrospective because we've been doing everything the right way. I mean, art is about like maneuverability and experimentation. And we're the tiniest pawns in the art world are the traditional realist artists, right? And the sort of painting that I'm interested in is not interesting to everybody, but it's really interesting to me. And I always think like, you know, if you go to cooking school, they'll talk to you about different types of cuisine. You'll learn, you know, traditional French cuisine and sauces, but you'll discuss Indian spices and all different stuff. If art schools were cooking schools, it's like they're trying to browbeat you into, no, it's just this one cuisine, but we all have different taste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good analogy.
You know, I do miss that feeling of like, I think I also like, I studied at a time, maybe back then it was the New York Academy of Art, but feeling like if there was just enough, maybe a few hundred people who really know how to paint, like feeling like you're on the edge of something and that maybe the world is changeable. And right now there's the kind of painting that I like, maybe we all like, is much more commonly accepted Like in the early 2000s, maybe there were only a few hundred people. So on one hand, like I never have to have the conversation at a party where I find myself defending, just liking to really, you know, to render something really, really small and compulsive, right? Or like, I don't have to defend what I do as much, but that feeling of like being on the edge of something world-changing is also gone. Although I don't know if that's like maybe being like 40 and not 20.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's okay. You know, like I think the reason you do this is you do it for yourself, right? Like it's, you do it, what's that? There's an old quote, like the only art student that should be encouraged is that which you cannot discourage, something like that. And, you know, at this point, a lot of the people that I went to school with that were quite talented, you know, have gone on to do much more reasonable jobs. I mean, they want financial security. And, you know, I'm, you know, also in my 40s in 2023, and you read back like Solomon J. Solomon from like 120 years ago, and it talks about the exact same thing, like the most talented people at the easel, over time they drop off, and the very best of all of them, I won't mention his name, I mean I'm not going to be able to do the quote from memory, but it's in the beginning of the book, he's like and the student that was not even the most talented, he's now among the finest painters of our day. And I think this concept's always existed, right? It's like it just gets harder the longer you go on and the longer you try to figure stuff out. A friend of mine had a quote, he said painting is like riding a bicycle. If every time you ride a bicycle, it gets more difficult to ride it. And Tom Hughes, he's a good painter from here in New England.
Well, I think that's so great. Like Dina and I talk, it's like from interviewing so many artists, they sort of trickle into a few archetypes we find. And there's like this lifer archetype that is wherever on the range of talent or opportunities or privilege they lie on, there's just some people who are just going to do it forever at the stake of a lot of better choices they can make in their life or whatever. And I always love those. I always love talking to those and getting insight, because I think that's someone who's just compelled to do something over and over again. And there's a slow and steady climb in terms of ability and facility and vision. And it's just, those are the most compelling artists to me, the ones who are just going to do it.
Yeah. Very practically impractical, right?
Like exactly.
I hit a point years ago where, you know, you hit your mid 30s and family expands and expenses get serious and mortgages start looming, and you know, I had a real like talk with myself about who I am and what I did. And I realized, I hadn't thought about it, but like my last job was in 1999. I delivered pizzas for Baldini's Pizza in Kenmore Square in Boston on a scooter. And like rain, sleet, or snow, I was out on a scooter delivering pizzas. And I was like, holy shit, can I swear?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm like, holy shit, that was my last job. I have no other skills. I'm like really skilled in this one thing. So it's like, it's this or nothing. And I think that was kind of a breaking point for me, where I realized it's just all my cards are on the table.
So what separates your work in your interest, maybe your interest in painting, from your education? Like where would you deviate from that and bring your own personality into it?
I think that a lot of the painting that I'm interested in is kind of, I don't want to say rejected, but kind of poo-pooed or ignored by a lot of that atelier stuff. It's not just the Florence Academy or something, but it's like all of them. If you talked to some of the people that ran studios like that during the 20th century, I think they would have ranked like Claude Monet, you know, take like Ives Gamel here in Boston, really would have put Claude Monet among some of the greatest painters of all time. And I got to Florence and I got really into all sorts of 19th century academic painting. And I eventually, one day I realized that I like Monet. And they don't talk about Monet at all. In fact, what they talk about is how the drawing's not good enough. I'm not kidding, right?
Like I know. I've been in those plenty of those rooms. It always strikes me as the height of arrogance from
the quote I overheard, and this one is like is a doozy, but I overheard from, because you know, there you're working in cubicles. So it's supposed to be really quiet, but if anybody's having a conversation or talking, you know, everybody can kind of hear it. And I overheard two people talking, and one said, he said, you know, I can't even look at those Michelangelo sanguine drawings anymore. I mean, the proportions are terrible. And even then I think I was able to chuckle at it, but I realized pretty quickly that, after getting some chops and figuring out a little bit how to draw and paint, that as impressive as Bouguereau is technically, and Bouguereau is really impressive technically, that's just not the painting I would want to hang in my house. I can appreciate it technically. I believe that you have a technical compass, but you also have an aesthetic compass. And those two things don't necessarily align with one another. I think for art students, they should align for some time so you figure stuff out. But my aesthetic compass is, I think, pretty divergent from the technical place it used to be. So I woke up one day and I was like, wait a minute. And it sort of happened in the whole school. Bouguereau was this figurehead kind of, or really, you know, highest point. And then really, while I was there, I think the school started to move towards being much more interested in John Sargent and Andrew Zorn and you know, to a lesser degree, Sorolla. And then I slowly realized that of those three, the lesser degree Sorolla, that's actually my favorite of the three. And I really like French Impressionism, and I really like American Impressionist painting of the 20th century. And I sort of just realized that aesthetically I was, it was a little different. I was into light and color. I think I satisfied my needs and thinking about value. I still like Baroque painting a lot. I mean, I love a Rembrandt. I love a Ribera. Ribera is like Dan Graves's favorite painter, and you can talk about him all day long. I love the stuff, but I'm after something like inspiring and light and color, trying to emanate light back towards the viewer. Like this optical effect of the painting glowing almost like a window.
That's so good to hear you say that, because I noticed that in your work, like flipping through and knowing a little bit about your backstory. And I was like, oh, he's definitely interested. And it was nice, like when you said Sorolla, I was like, oh, that makes so much sense. You're definitely capturing that in the work.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I mean, it's a hard thing because it's very related to what I did years ago, but I've tried to apply the same standards of like Baroque building of texture and surface to build something that emanates light and feels luminous and even tenebrous or any fancy word you want to put to it. But I've instead tried to do it with, just paintings of the world around and even invented paintings, not necessarily just, you know, brown portraits.
Right.
So by the way, Bouguereau is probably the most controversial for like a man who painted so many, you know, young, just like sort of bland young ladies with really nice skin, right? He's like he's the most controversial painter that comes up on this podcast. Like we had Bert Silverman, who called him like something like a pornographer, maybe even a child pornographer. We had someone else who thought that he was like the pinnacle of painting. How do you guys, you know, and I mean, honestly, like I admired him for his skill. He never really like did it for me in a lot of ways, but I don't think I felt nearly as strongly about him as a lot of the people that have brought him up. How do you guys feel? you know, like Marshall, is he, you know, pornographer or master of light?
I think he would be canceled today. But no, I love that type of painting, like really smooth, beautiful, luminous shadows, smooth transitions. Like, I love it. But I think kind of like what Leo said, if I'm to say, do I love the paintings for anything but just the surface? No. I mean, I don't really like the subject matter, but that's a broader topic. I don't like the subject matter of a lot of paintings, you know. Yeah. But sure, I don't really care for the subject matter. I don't like how they're composed. I just like the way that he paints a human, you know, just in that smooth surface. But
I know. Cool. Did you guys read that Leonard Cohen book, Beautiful Losers? Like it's just like unbelievably, it's like amazing and amazingly fucked up, and like, you know, just like brings you into his head in a way which makes it feel like it's both like, I don't know, a prison and a museum. But I think one of the quotes from that book is, we must learn to stop bravely at the surface. Like there's, you know, like there's too much emphasis on what's underneath, and, you know, and we, you know, sometimes it's what's on the surface that matters. Maybe Booger is like that.
Yeah. I mean, he's the stuff's amazing, right? But I often think about the paintings that I can appreciate versus the paintings I'd want to hang in my home. And people smarter than me, like an art historian I read once, called Bouguereau the death nail of academic painting. And I think that there's, you know, many people would sort of support that, right? He's like but as a painter, he's incredible, right? You read about his work day. He would, you know, paint all day, skip lunch, come out for dinner, leave dinner, go back to the studio, keep painting. The sheer amount that the man produced is amazing. The one sort of flag I would kind of plant, well, I'll plant two. One is that I think it's interesting, a lot of people today that are really into Bouguereau, I don't think have inspected a lot of them up close, because when you see Bouguereau's, they have really amazing technique and brushwork and strange kind of calligraphy sometimes in them. But I think a lot of people look at their reproductions and imagine them as this like really smooth licked surface exclusively, which they're not. And the other one is, I just think it's kind of funny or cute that it was Michael Jackson who reintroduced, like he re-elevated Bouguereau by buying them. I think that was the first Bouguereau that I noticed was back in the 90s or something. There was an article about his art collection and his Bouguereaus. It was
that's such an interesting parallel, because Michael Jackson and him have so many similarities in the depth of their work is very surface, but very smooth at the same time, you know, like hits the notes, hits the music notes, but like that's a great parallel.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like the most talented, just rocks. Nobody has chops like Bouguereau. Nobody. And yet I would rather look at or own a painting of a child by Sorolla, Mancini, you know, Antonio Mancini is like, you know, to me, that's, maybe it's one is five times the technique and the other one's five times the art to me.
Totally.
You know, so one thing I've got to say though, is like, I went to university where there wasn't much figurative, you know, you had to like really dig deep in like the faculty and, you know, to try to even like find someone who cared about the same stuff that you did art-wise.
Yep.
And, but I had a really good art history professor, and it's this guy would, you know, the closest good museum was the Clark in Williamstown. And there was a year where I must have like hitchhiked there. It was like a good, you know, 2 hours of like, you know, like driving, like I must've hitchhiked there like five times to write this paper on Bouguereau, because that, you know,
Nymphs and Satyr.
The Nymphs and Satyr, if you see it at like 1920 and you've never seen that kind of art before, like it blew my mind back then.
It's an amazing painting. It's an amazing painting.
I still think it's one of the best butts in, you know, like the in the history of art, like one of
personally, I'll take the Rubens Three Graces butts. but you can choose that one if you like.
You know, I'm a different person now too. Like my adult taste maybe gravitates towards the Rubens, but so by the way, Leo, just because we've had people on this podcast with kids, most of the people that talk about parenting are women. And you happen to be someone I talk about parenting with because you have children.
Where are they?
Leo, right behind you, left shoulder. So how did that affect how did that affect your life as an artist? Because you're also, I think, unlike kind of the previous generation of people that, you know, men that had children and kind of outsourced it to their wives, you actually like do this parenting thing.
I'm a very involved dad, and I spend a lot of time with my kids, and I'm gonna cry. I said I wouldn't cry, but like, it's like really, no, it's an emotional thing for me. This thing where I became a dad, like, changed my painting life so much. And I went from being somebody that had all the time in the world and I could spend, you know, 8-10 hours a day in the studio. I really miss those days, right? Like, I miss painting on Christmas Day and, like, you know, quickly Skyping with my family back home. But like, Christmas Day was painting, Easter was painting, like holidays, there was no vacations, like everything was a work trip. And I had so much time. And now, like, I have less hours in the day than I've ever had in my adult life for myself. And yet somehow I do so much more than I've ever done. I travel to teach. I host people to teach. I have students that come here. I paint my pictures and send them out to shows and dealers. I have a art materials business. There's just so much that I do with so little time, and mostly why it's emotional is I think, what did I do with all this time I had before? Right? Like, I feel like I wish I was so much more efficient than I have been, because I'm like efficient down to the minute at this point. Hmm. You know, I bring my son to act. Me and Dina's, our older sons do a couple activities together. You know, I bring him to activities, classes, swim lessons, like all this stuff. And I'm never a minute late. And somehow I'm able to pack in a full day of work in less hours than I ever had before. So it's an incredible project. It's been great. For painting was the hardest thing I had ever done until I tried to paint and be a responsible dad at the same time.
And then I have like a similar, like, I had so much time, you know, like, so at the time I met Marshall, like it was probably what, our late 20s, something like that. But other than that job, like, maybe I was teaching out in Long Island, and maybe like, and we had that job together where I was there 2 days a week, and the rest of the time I would wake up at 6 a.m. and I'd paint for 12 hours a day. Like, and now like a 6-hour painting day is like a good, you know, that's a lot of time. And I was like, back then, 6 hours, you're just getting started. Like, you're just getting really into it. So I sometimes also, I'm like, what did I do with all that time? But I think we were like painting and learning how to be. The upside of all this is that painting doesn't feel as serious anymore. Like now it's a place I go to get a break rather than the place.
It's not that way for me. Not at all. Like, it's very, I'm very serious about it still. I mean, I do maybe take more pleasure in it than I used to, but I try to treat it as serious as possible. And I come up with my paintings, like, if you saw my studio's like disorganized, there's stuff everywhere right now, but like my paintings sometimes look broken color and crazy. Maybe they look a certain way to people, but I'm meticulous about planning my painting day and what my jobs will be. And I try to paint every day that I don't have another project going on in the studio. I'm trying to work on, you know, just in a Sisyphus kind of way, just push the rock up the hill, one more time. And yeah.
That, by the way, is also, I mean, it's a parenting feels like to me as well. Like, it's just, you know, I just feel like painting is an easier rock, like because it doesn't try, it like never tries to kick me in the face, you know, like accidentally on purpose.
A couple paintings have kicked me in the face.
But never as strongly as your toddler. So
no,
I think, I mean, I can't speak to parenting, but like everything is just more fragmented now. To Leo's point earlier about just the rise of social media, and we're on a Zoom call right now, everybody's in their studio, and just do you guys feel that, even barring painting, just interruptions in your studio days constantly that have not, that weren't there 10 years ago? It just feels like the phone is always needing attention, and there's always some scheduled Zoom meeting for something, always.
Yep.
And when did this happen?
There's a crisis every day, like every day.
Every day. And yep. Yeah, you guys have kids. I don't even have kids. I'm like, but it's so fragmented, and there's always something on the schedule. Where I remember, because Dina, what sparked it in my mind, you were talking about when we met each other, I didn't have to do anything. Like, the phone didn't matter in my life at that point, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like,
I don't think I had a reliable internet connection till like 2010 or something. I didn't know what Facebook was. I didn't do any of that, you know?
Well, so when I was a kid, like pre-internet, I was one of those bulletin board kind of dial-up modem kids. Like, some of my friends that I had, I actually met online long before the internet, these like community forums that you'd log into. And I was reminiscing, it used to be called like Freaking with a PH. I was one of these kids. It goes hand in hand with the graffiti thing and the trying to get everything for free. But we had these little boxes that would whistle chimes, and you'd hold it to a payphone, and you could get free calls.
I've heard about this.
Yeah. So I've had the experience of like chatting with friends online for, I think, longer than most people. Yet I've never been more busy and fragmented than like before we started this interview. If you guys know Clayson's Canvas in Belgium, I've been importing directly from them. And it's such a headache trying to deal with anything sort of supply chain related these days. So, and I don't have control, right? If I'm importing this massive amount of canvas, I have, you know, it's going to sit on a pallet. It got stuck in customs. And then just 10 minutes before we started this call is when, without telling me that it was going to come, they came and brought the equivalent of, I don't even want to say, it's so much canvas, right? Like, I had to get help from a friend and student to help move it all, because it was more than I could possibly do myself. And I was still sweating when we started the Zoom call. So like, that's what my studio day is like. I try to paint and there's just some crisis that pops up.
So what do you do with that? Can you from there with the business you're working with, do they get cut down and mounted? How does that work?
So yeah, I started a company. It's a concept, right? Like I for many years while I was in Italy, I was I taught like some of the normal stuff, but I was really into materials. Like, I was really into materials, and there was few people within the school that were going to go really deep into like mulling pigments and varnishes, mediums and oil, you know, all the uber nerdy material stuff. I got into it and made a deal with myself that I would sort of grind each color before I bought a tube every time something new was introduced to the palette. And Dan Graves is a huge materials guy, and the art store in Florence is a big difference from the art store here, because they can actually give really clear material advice, right? So by the time I left Italy, I had already been lecturing about art materials for years to the students there. I sort of was helping Dan run the materials program with lectures. And when I came back to the States, I started trying to do lectures, but it turned out that here there was not enough of the kind of prerequisite experience that people had. So it had to become a hands-on workshop. So like for years, I would teach people to make, really wonderful old style rabbit skin glue gesso panels done the same way that they were done in the Renaissance. So this is like Giorgio Vasari's recipe. This is Cennino Cennini's recipe. This is the very first books that were ever written on art materials. This is an unchanged recipe. And everything from that to grinding pigments and stretching canvas and troubleshooting, anything. And during those classes, I begged people, I told this to well over 100 people that were students over the years in this class. I just begged them. I said, please start a materials company. Here's what you do. You do X, Y, Z, and I would like you to please give me money off for the rest of my artistic life. It's a great business plan, and I think one of you will be successful. And nobody did it. So at this point, I have started a sort of concept, which is it's really a art material company that's by artists and for artists, right? So I'm taking on a lot of input from other high-level professional painters in the community, right? People come to me with interesting questions. Like Dina, for instance, had a cool idea. She wanted to paint on Mylar and it had been having trouble mounting it. So that's become one of the things that it's called Mako, the company Mako Supply. So the website's www.mako.supply. And Mako is able to mount stuff that I think other people have struggled with. So she requested Mylar panels and has been painting on Mylar, whereas other people have come to me and asked me to mount watercolor paper so that they can paint water-based media without the paper buckling, without stretching it. The Mako thing has been quite a ride.
Leo, two things. A, if I could like make a pitch for Leo's company, even the stuff that is not Mylar panels, because I've tried a bunch of yours, is really, really good. Before I came to you with that, how do you mount Mylar thing, I pitched to like 5 different art supply companies. And then at some point I painted something on Mylar and no frame store in town, like no frame store I had anything to do with, was willing to mount it. Like, mm-hmm. So I was willing to pay people money to just mount and frame this one thing that was already done. And not like a bunch of them just wouldn't do it. One of the nicer guys, not only would he not do it, he was like, you just can't, this doesn't work. Like you can't mount this, but so I was like, I'll just try it myself. So he didn't do it, but he did give me this extremely toxic stuff. And he's like, basically when you fuck it up trying to do it yourself, this is what's going to dissolve the adhesive for like when you make a mess of it. So I'll give you a bottle of that stuff. So, you figured out how to do the things that like no one else seems to have figured out. And I've been like trying to do this for years, but, Leo, there's like one more thing and I totally spaced out. The Mylar panels are really good. Keep talking. Maybe I'll remember it. There's one more good thing about Mako that like I meant to bring up.
Something came to my mind. So with all your examining of this, and I'll go to museums and look at how paintings have held up, mm-hmm. and just want to know if you have an opinion, why do Rembrandts hold up so well? And why are like Sargents all cracked up?
They're almost exclusively painted on rigid supports.
That's the big thing, right?
Yeah. So like one of the problems is just the ambient humidity causes expansion and contraction and stretched canvas. And there's a degree of cracking that's just inevitable because of it. Wood panels create a number of issues too. There's some expansion and contraction, but so that's one point, is that they're almost exclusively on rigid supports. Even if they're on canvas, they're mounted to wood. Let's also be honest, Rembrandt is Rembrandt, and people are going to take care of their paintings that have been done by Rembrandt, and restorers are going to make their careers on a single improvement on the state of a Rembrandt picture. And while John Sargent is thought of as very important these days within our community, I'm from Boston. And I remember when I was young, the reintroduction of Sargent as an important artist. There was no book in print on John Sargent through the I believe it was the late 80s. I mean, they did not exist for a very long time. There was almost nothing in print. And if Dina, if you remember when we were kids, there was that street artist here in Boston called Sidewalk Sam.
Yeah.
You remember Sidewalk Sam?
Yeah, I remember Sidewalk Sam.
Yeah, Sidewalk Sam, he was awesome. He would do really impressive, full-colored, you know, before I ever went to Italy and I saw the Madonnare. The Madonnare are the people that do the Madonnas in the street in Italy. So he was like almost that level. And they had a sergeant retrospective for the first time at the MFA. And Sidewalk Sam had sergeants everywhere. And it was like the big question was, why have we forgotten about this great Bostonian? And then I moved to Italy and it turned out he was born in Florence. And he never came to America till I think his mid-23 or 22 or something. But he's a Bostonian.
Hey, did you know that he actually had a pretty similar childhood to you? So I found out about this.
Sidewalk Sam?
No, not Sidewalk Sam, Sergeant.
The restorer is going to do with this Sidewalk Sam.
And yes, I also met Sidewalk Sam in detention, underachieving. No, okay, so Sergeant, I found out about this recently because I was researching his sketchbooks for this class I was teaching, and apparently he was like this very, very chaotic kid. And like a very chaotic teenager who kept getting kicked out of school and like couldn't sit still, was always bouncing off the walls. And his parents, actually similar to your parents, instead of trying to like fit his square peg into a round hole, after he got kicked out of like a certain number of institutions, they decided that like they saw that the one thing that keeps him, you know, like from bouncing off the walls is painting and drawing. So they decided that the best way for Sargent to, you know, like to bring him up was to travel Europe with him. And they had like some resources. So travel Europe, do a lot of plein air drawing, go to a lot of museums. And I think in like a lot of the places they stopped in, they'd hire him like a drawing tutor because that was something he could concentrate on. So
That must be why they don't have a plaque on his house in Florence when he was born. I always thought it was because, you know, they already have plaques for Michelangelo and, you know, other people, but it must be because he was delinquent.
Yeah, but really it's just because he got kicked out of somewhere or other.
Yeah. So
one more supply question. What's going to happen to like the Helen Frankenthalers or Kenneth Nolan that was a lot of thin solvent on like raw canvas that are now what, like 60, 70 years old? What's going to happen to those things?
Like painting with a lot of solvent, that presents two different issues, right? To paint on raw canvas is to paint on something without whiting behind it. You know, one of the words for white in ground used to be called whiting because you wanted something white behind so that as the paint stood on it, it would help to, you know, make the paint very luminous. And I think the best example that most painters can think of in that regard is Velazquez, right? So all the early Velazquezes are done on a dark red bowl ground, as was traditional. And then there's this point where he switches to a very light bone-colored ground. And if you compare those paintings together, as those paintings have aged and oil paints become more translucent over time, the ones painted on the dark ground are much less luminous. They are less Velazquez, right? They really look like what we think of, you know, Forge of the Vulcan and Mars and these amazing paintings. Whereas the early stuff presents much more with that sort of Baroque brown, somber tonality. And a lot of that is a function of the ground. The other issue is by painting with a lot of solvent, you don't get a really strong surface, right? The polymer that's created is it suspends all the pigment in place on the painting. And if you use a lot of solvent, you get a really matte thing that can look fine, but it's never going to be as luminous as something painted on a light background canvas and with oil, which then increases the subsurface light scattering and is what makes paint appear jewel-like, so that as you look at it, it sort of feels like it's emitting light back at you. Sorry, is that too long-winded?
Great answer. No, that was I love that thought.
Here's what I meant to ask about could Mako Supplies Could you, if watercolor paper has already buckled, could you still mount it for me so that it stops being buckled?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. In that case, next Taekwondo class.
Not for everybody, but for you, Dina.
Okay. So next time we'll talk about mounting it before I painted on it and had a buckle. But
it's actually interesting you asked me that. So talking about these to finish up what Marshall was saying. Talk about the way different people do stuff. What's fun about materials is analysis. It's like learning taste and learning process. But like, if those paintings look great, great, good for them. It's awesome. Like, you don't need to do everything the way that I'm saying. It's just materials are about choices, but materials also give you maneuverability. So in your case with the buckled watercolor paper, that's really similar to somebody who came to my studio with, I think it was on a client's wall. The client shipped it back. It was a large commission, I assume. The painting had gone slack. It had a crease in it from the stretcher bars. And yeah, just, I understand why the client shipped it back. So for her, I was able to perfectly dry mount it. So it, you know, it looks like $1 million. And now, we can remove the varnish for her. And now she can touch up the painting and ship it back to the client's house. And it'll be good shape for, you know, hopefully the next few hundred years. That's what's fun about materials is art in general, I think, is about problem solving. And it's just one more aspect of that problem solving thing.
Well, I'd be very grateful if you problem solved my, I did? It wasn't the watercolor. I put water varnish on these watercolors thinking that, like, you know, there's so much black in them that I wanted it to become like, you know, I wanted it to stop being matte, and the water varnish buckled the paper like crazy.
Water-based stuff is, yeah, it distorts things. So like a great surface to paint on, a lot of people like painting on these watercolor papers that have been prepared. But if you paint with like a PVA size or rabbit skin glue or anything water-based, acrylic medium or what you just described, it'll buckle the paper. But if you simply give a sheet of paper a coat of copal varnish or sandarac or shellac or any sort of hard varnish that's ideally fast drying, the paper stays perfectly flat and you can fit 100 paintings in a portfolio. I mean, you guys know this because you both do paintings and sketchbooks, right? Like, paper is a wonderful surface. It's very underused today.
Yeah, I love it. And you have paper mounted on the support with your supply company?
I do. I mean, it's not, I'm being careful rolling stuff out slowly because I've gotten a lot of sort of high level painters, good folks, like some of which are friends, some of which I didn't know before they contacted me, but word travels through the grapevine pretty fast in our world. So I have been cautious about rolling things out slowly. What's on the website right now are, the Clayson's canvas, which is, I think certainly the highest level industrial made canvas today, right? It's Belgian linen. They've been made for more than 100 years. There's Van Goghs that were painted on Clayson's. Like, it's great to work directly with the company, although import process is kind of a lot for a painter like me. So I have a canvas that's mounted, and I also have an ACM panel, is this new, really celebrated by restorers product, which is used, and my wife's an architect, it's used in the architectural industry, it's used in street signs, and it's been extensively tested for temperature variation and breakdown over time. And the good news is ACM panel does not expand and contract with humidity, and the stuff feels like you could drive a tank over it. So it's sort of an ideal panel. So those are like the main things that it's starting with. And these are all, I should mention, like, these are based on my research in conservation, like what conservators do today in museums. If you bring a conservator a John Sargent that's cracking and you want to pay to have it properly relined, the first thing they'll do is mount the painting to a rigid support, likely one of these ACM aluminum composite panels. I use the exact same glue that they use. So the Beva 371 is like the most popular conservator glue for many, many years now. So I'm using the top of the line restoration glue. So the canvases that are coming from Mako are already treated with what conservators you would pay much money to have them treated with, you know, 50 years from now when they've gone slack and cracking. So the concept is sort of museum quality right from the start. And then as that gets rolling and word of mouth spreading is something that I'm comfortable with, because I'm very cautious to be a painter first. I don't want it to get out of control. I'll start rolling out mediums, paper mounted, maybe Mylar mounted will become one of the products. There's a lot of cool stuff in the pipeline, and it all comes from the kind of artist team like Dina, who's been helping me kind of think tank all these different things. So yeah, the paper thing is very cool. I told you, Marshall, I'll send you a box of samples of stuff and we'll see what you like.
Oh, that'd be great. That would be awesome. So I have a crazy, a bit of an off the wall question, but it's on my mind. And we were talking about the last 20 years being a painter, and all three of us being invested in handmade goods and the way that you're talking about really in depth and from the ground up, like these are our interests and we love paint and we love using it. Leo, where do you think we're in this next phase that could arguably be weirder than the last 20 years, like with AI and stuff? How do you see that affecting traditional arts?
I don't.
Yeah, I fully agree with Leo. I don't think it's going to, the kind of people that would find, you know, that would even find this conversation interesting, where like, you know, what kind of rabbit skin glue and what kind of support, like those are different people. Like I think people have always been into the kind of painting that we like for the paint and for the artist's hand. And there's going to be set, like AI can do cool stuff. I think it's just going to be a different set of people or a different, you know, it's just different. It's not competing with human art. It's creating its own thing. But Leo, sorry, I cut you off.
No, I agree. Like I make single objects that I paint with like a lot of impasto and indirect like glazing and scraping and things that don't even reproduce well in a photo. Like my paintings are very much meant to be viewed in person. And what I don't do prints. When over the years people ask me to sell them a print, I send them a really high quality JPEG and I say, great, take it to a poster store. And they say, you want money? I say, no, just do it. Print 20 of them. I don't care. I'm not interested in anything other than single beautiful objects. And I want each one to be different than the last. And another thing I would put there is one of my friends works in, it's not really the AI space, but it's robotics. And he's built through code it's an amazing process of code that uses a plotter to do all sorts of really complicated drawings. They're awesome. But he still has to consult me about what kind of brush to use for the robot to get an interesting calligraphic line. Right? Like there's still knowledge that painters are going to have that's so esoteric, right? Like I don't look at AI as a threat or anything. I just think it's really cool. I like the new ones where they're showing you these people that never really existed, but they all have like 7 fingers and 45 teeth in their mouth. I don't know if you guys have seen these.
I've seen those. I think we're always interested in what we can do. Like I do think it threatens a lot of other, like if I was a writer or if I did legal writing today, I'd be like, oh shit, my job's done.
The chat GPT, like it can explain a lot, right? Like what you just said is very true. Like legal writing, it can write a paragraph as well as a human right now.
Well, you know what? I think it's because most of us who are not lawyers don't actually understand legal writing. So it's like, I think maybe a lawyer could tell the difference, but for most of us who don't understand it anyway, yeah, we can't tell the difference between like ChatGPT and like real legal writing. But like, yeah. I don't think there's no difference. I think we're just lay people.
Yeah, I feel like we're always going to be interested in what humans can do. Like, if a machine can hit a home run, I'm sure it can. I'm sure they could have a robot to do that. It's not going to be as interesting as a human doing it. It'll always be compartmentalized in two separate things.
Hey, guys, have you read Ted Chiang?
No.
Okay, you like, Leah, I actually can't imagine you having time to read ever. So Marshall, you're going to like, or anyone listening, if you have time to read, Ted Chiang is wonderful, but he was, I think, not trained to be a writer. I think he actually was like a computer guy. And he wrote a few short story collections that are like, it's like sci-fi. I mean, it pretends to be sci-fi, but it basically just examines the nature of existence and like the meaning of life. It's totally wonderful. But he's got this one called the life cycle of digital objects, I think, that is like one of the funniest, smartest short stories I've ever read that kind of addresses a lot of what we're talking here. Except it's about it's about digital pets. Okay, I'm off that. You know, maybe that should all be deleted. Actually, that was just me being excited about like a new writer that I found. But it's kind of like the last one I read of his is this really short thing, like a few pages, about a little device which proves beyond the shadow of a doubt. I think it predicts something happening within the next few minutes. And because it's capable of that prediction, just something goes off, like a little light bulb saying this will happen in a few minutes. And like a third of the people that use it can't live with the knowledge that they have, like, basically proves beyond the shadow of a doubt with this 5-minute prediction that there's no such thing as free will. And like a third of the people using it can't live with this fact and kill themselves just from this little light going off, like knowing that they can't control their next 5 minutes. So I'm not doing a good job. All right.
No. There's a great philosophical argument around the concept that free will doesn't exist. I think the philosopher is called Daniel Dennett. It's an amazing concept and very, very compelling. But yeah, I'm not able to read much these days.
I don't think there is free will, even from a Christian perspective. Like, how could they, if you are coming at it from that perspective, the movie's already been written. How do you have free will within it?
Well, from a Christian perspective, you don't. But from like let's say from an atheist perspective, or like, you know, do you really think there's no free will?
I don't think there's free will. Yeah.
Well, according to the short story, we actually most like a third of us won't be able to live with the proof that there's no free will.
People rail against this argument. Like, people actually get really up in arms about it. But it's I think his name's Dennett. It's a really compelling, really rock tight. It's even more rock tight than the thing that we all live in a simulation, which is also a fun rabbit hole to go down. But like, I think of life like we're all trapped in this kind of continuum, right? And we make the best choices that we are presented with at any time. But those choices based on our place in life are, you know, pretty easy to predict sometimes. But we like to think that we have all this agency in every moment, but we are part of a continuum, and painting is part of a continuum.
You know what I'm scared of? I'm scared that we actually only have agency in the good things that happen in our life. Like we, you know, we can work, you know, whatever, we can work harder, finish something, complete a project, put something out in the world, but we have, you know, and we have agency in that, like how late we stay up, how early we wake up and do, you know, like how well we concentrate. I feel like we have no agency in the bad things that happen. Like a cell could divide the wrong way, and then the next thing you know, you're dead within the year. Or, you know, like a brick falls on your head, you get hit by a car. Like, I feel like we only have agency in what requires work and, you know, like, and maybe in the positives of life, but almost none in like the infinite number of bad things that could happen.
Are you talking about how we're supposed to be in the roaring 20s right now, the era of cocktail parties and fun and everybody being together and hugging and kissing?
I don't actually know how to have fun. So that's, you know, like as a not fun person, no, I'm not talking about that.
I think it's like, I think my cousin who works for Google and is on the engineering side and really high up. He's been there forever. And you know how people will say, oh my God, I was just talking about that, whatever, that thing. I was talking about that scarf that I bought and now Google Listen and it's all advertisements about scarves. You know what I'm saying? People, everybody says that.
Yeah.
Cousin's like, no, that's such a cumbersome thing to put a device that could, from your microphone, that could hear, order those thoughts, pick out keywords, bring them to an advertiser and send them to you. He's like, no, people are just incredibly predictable based on a few actions. Mm. So he said that it knows what to send you and you're in a group, he said, of 10,000 other people that it just know you're just like them based on where you live, how old you are, just very simple things. And you'll want those things. And it knows that. And he said, by the way, we've dialed those buckets down to like the 1,000. So it's only 1,000 people. And they start getting really creeped out and stop engaging because they think it's listening all the time. Mm. It's just people don't have really much agency. You're just who you are. And a machine can throw you in a bucket of 10,000 and you're okay with it because you're like, hey, it's kind of listening. It's sort of.
That reminds me of, it was years ago, but it was the first like big case of that. It was, I think, a teenage girl who didn't even know yet that she was pregnant and her parents didn't know she was pregnant. And it started sending baby stuff to her. And that's how she found, like she somehow the machine learning was able to figure out that she was pregnant with child before she did.
Well, that's something that freaks me out too, because I know that it will sense, like all the smartwatches and things people wear, little deviations in your health that you won't key into. That information could really be creepy.
Yeah, but listen, I mean, my father has heart disease and is very much he's, as we've called him, the family bullet dodger. And I'm very appreciative of the fact he wears an Apple Watch. It gives him a heads up if his, you know, heart's moving in a weird direction. Like there's amazing advances. Like my views on a lot of things are pretty old school, but I love my iPhone.
No, I mean, it's magical in a lot of ways and practical in a million ways, but also kills a lot of the other magic. And I have like really mixed feelings about technology. To quote Google Bordello, there's never any good old days. I pretty much think that like everything that we think nostalgically back on, there's probably 200 things happening like at the same moment that were much worse than everything happening right now. But that being said, you know, like watching even like kids the age of my kids interacting with technology and even like watching my little like, so I cut out screen, I mean, and I'm like one of these terrible parents that just like cut out screen time altogether for my kids. And it's not because I hate it so much. It's because I saw my 4-year-old at some point, like looking at YouTube videos. And like, he's so, you know, most of the time he's curious and he's also a little chaotic and he's magical. Second, you give him a phone, something that types and something that has these pictures, like something that's a screen, all he does is turn into like a little typing, you know, like a little, like, kind of zombie. And I'm like, and that's what it does. And I was like, all right, like I saw that once of just him flipping from one video to another. And I was like, all right, this is just not going to happen in our house anymore. Mm. Go ahead.
With all this, you know, talk about technology, what is magical to you about painting? What keeps you going back to something like a painting that we all three have devoted our lives to and really love? What, if you could put your finger on that, what would it be?
I mean, I think it's important that we define what we're talking about within the art world and painting, right? Because like you were talking about the AI thing before. I think there are artists that are might have their careers threatened by what we're talking, but the sort of painting that I'm interested in is like firmly rooted in the humanist tradition going back to ancient Greece, right? It is a celebration of the human condition and joy of life and analysis of what it's like to live in the modern world. I mean, whether I'm looking at, you know, a piece of sculpture from antiquity or something from the Baroque, like, you know, Rembrandt is a great example, or something from the 19th century that's, you know, very academic, you know, we used the Bouguereau example before. They're all real, like, celebrations of being in space and time at that moment. And hopefully paintings, from my point of view, hopefully paintings are a joyful expression. Like, even if the content's sad or whatever, I mean, I like paintings that are put down with a sort of passion and urgency and really feel like the painter's engaged in its subject. And I also like a kind of painting that's a bit of a magic trick. Like, I don't like paintings that are purely literal. I don't like when a painting kind of looks the same up close to me as it looks from a distance. I don't want every little thing spelled out for me. I want to be able to fill in the rest. I think that's like a really, that's like engaging the viewer as they're a part of the experience. I want my paintings to look ostensibly different at 30 feet, then they do at 20 feet, then they do at 10 feet, then they look when you're scratch and sniff with them. And I want every corner of the painting to be kind of an interesting little abstract pattern of calligraphy. It's just, that's really what I'm into, as a celebration of our experience, and also a celebration of paint itself. Like, I don't paint without brushstroke. I want to show as much calligraphy and brushstroke as possible, because I'm not trying to compete against my iPhone. I think that it's great if people want to go for really, 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 really high finish stuff, but I don't want my paintings to ever be mistaken for photos. In fact, I look at photos and I know that photo looks just like a painting, you know? And I think a lot of painters don't feel the same way that I do, but I'm very sure about this. And it's a global con. I mean, you see it everywhere, right? There's painters from Australia that painted like this, the Russian 19th century, and then social realists of the 20th century painted like this. The French impressionists painted like this. The Italians painted like this. Like, you can really see the elements of what I'm talking about as a global phenomenon in painting. And that's what I'm interested in. And other people have other interests, but I think that's me.
That's great.
So Leo, because you have to go and I've got to go stop by my grandma's before picking up the kids, but I guess, to what Marshall was saying earlier about people who are in it for life, like, you're kind of a lifer, right? And generally we don't talk to people our own age. Like, you might be the first guest who's like in our age category. Like generally I try to aim for the ones who are like over 90, you know, the people who are left and still painting that age, but you're obviously in this for life. What bit of advice would you give to other people who are in this for life, just either about painting or making a living or just, you know, surviving in this particular way?
I mean, I think a lot about like how hard it is for young people to get into this work today, because there's so many options and so much competition. And I think it's important that everybody who wants to do this thinks very carefully, and I mean very carefully, about the reasons they want to do it. Like, if you're looking for accolades, this is not for you. This is a job that is done because you have no other choice, because it's a part of who you are. And it scratches at something at the very core of who you are. I mean, you guys teach, and you're well aware of how many people show up to workshops after retirement, and they painted and drew when they were young, and they just, it burned at them. And then, you know, they finally have the time to do it at a certain age, and they need to. So the important part is not where you go to school or how you might study. I mean, some schools are better than others, but I think the real core of it is that you do it because you have to, and because you need to. It's a part of my identity, and I wouldn't know who I am without it. And I think that's the way it is for a lot of the lifer. I mean, who knows if I'm a lifer? I'm a lifer so far, but I don't have anything else. And a lot of the people that had other skills or even had trust funds, they go on to do other things because they don't have the same fire to do, you know, not to generalize, but it's kind of true that I think you have to do it for yourself and you have to do it because you have no choice.
Thank you. And you know, one more thing, unless Marshall's got a final question, but my thing is, how can people, let's say, I don't know, find you, buy your magical art supplies?
Yeah. So the art supply thing is very easy. It's www.mako.supply. It's on Instagram. I think it's @mako_supply. That's easy. That's a normal business. For my teaching stuff, I actually don't publicize the classes I do very publicly. I have a mailing list, which is curated, and they're all people that we all get to know each other over the years, and people sort of pop in for classes and workshops. So it all happens through emailing directly. So for those things, that's the teaching studio is Waltham Studios in Waltham, Massachusetts. That's people just email me and it's waltham.studios@gmail.com. You go on the mailing list and then it all happens automatically through the mailing list. And I know that's a strange model. Like most people really like to publicize what they do, but I mean, I took my website half down years ago and there's just a few articles you can read on it because I didn't want to have as much of a public persona as I previously had. So I don't know. It's a weird space to be in, but I'm both kind of public and not, I guess. And I'm on Instagram. That's easy. It's @Leo_Mancini_Horesco.
Okay. So, like now as I think about it, you've made yourself hard to find. All right. So if anyone wants to track down Leo and study with him, there's no direct way to do that, but you could maybe show up outside of the Waltham Studios with a guitar and he'll maybe light you into the class. Seriously though, Leo knows more about, you know, more about a lot of stuff. You've probably forgotten more about art materials than most people have ever known. So.
I should mention, also, there's some cool upcoming classes. I have a couple workshops upcoming. One is I've been talking to Todd Casey, who just wrote a couple wonderful books about color. He'll be teaching through the studio early this spring. Peter Van Dyke, who's, do you guys know his work?
Yeah. I can vouch for Todd's new book. I bought it and it's fantastic. Yeah. Like it's those color books. A lot of students are like, what's a good color book? And it's like, I don't know. There's not many great ones, but that one's really good. So
cool. And I have a class that I'm teaching in the Shires of Vermont in, when is that? That's in April through the Bryan Gallery. I'll be doing a studio landscape painting class because that's a topic that I think a lot of people don't, everybody's into plein air, go out and paint an 8x10. This is much more about trying to take paintings that you've done and try to turn them into important studio pictures. Because many of the paintings that we admire in museums are certainly done indoors from studies. And then there's one other guy upcoming who's also a great painter. And I think you guys know his stuff. He's called Peter Van Dyke in Pennsylvania. He'll be coming to teach later this spring. So yeah, there's all sorts of cool stuff. You can get in touch with me, waltham.studios@gmail.com. You go on the mailing list and yeah, that's most of what's happening. Other than that, I'm just plugging along, doing my pictures and sending them off to shows.
That's great. Leo, it's been great talking to you.
Thanks guys.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you got some good painting done while we entertain you with our amazing guest. If you like what you're hearing, follow and subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so yet. And if you're so inclined, rate us whether you love or hate us. We love hearing all the different opinions and appreciate the feedback. You can reach out to us at artgrindpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on IG at ArtGrindPodcast. You faithful listeners have the power to help us grow. So please spread the word. It's free and you'll feel good about it. So until next time, stay on the grind while we fill your mind.